podcast land, and welcome back to the Front Row Network of Podcasts and our Oscar Spotlight series. My name is Lou Hare. I am the Guilty Pleasures host, but today we're going to be talking about Martin Scorsese's The Irishman. Now, this is going to be a little bit different than the Oscar Spotlights you might have heard, because what we're going to be doing is we're going to be re-releasing our initial discussion of The Irishman from our Full Disclosure series when it first dropped back in December. So I wanted to jump on at the top to give you a little bit of the Oscar preview part of this podcast, because when we did this podcast in early December, we of course didn't know what awards it was going to win, what it was going to be nominated for. So I wanted to take a moment up top just to talk about its nominations and what I think it's got a shot to win, what I hope it's winning, and to give you a little bit of a primer on that. So here it is. Martin Scorsese's The Irishman, nominated for 10 Academy Awards this year, tied for second most nominations, one behind Joker and tied with 1917. It is currently up for Best Film Editing, Production Design, Costume Design, Visual Effects, Cinematography, Adapted Screenplay, Supporting Actor for both Al Pacino and Joe Pesci, Best Director for Martin Scorsese, and of course, the big one, Best Picture. What's interesting to talk about when we're talking about The Irishman and the Academy Awards is I think we all kind of had this penciled in as one of the major players for awards season when it was first announced. We knew Martin Scorsese was getting all that Netflix money to put together his epic gangster movie and getting Joe Pesci out of retirement, getting De Niro, getting Pacino, everything on board. And certainly from a nomination standpoint, it has been that. It has racked up tons of nominations in every award show you can imagine. However, it has not racked up much in terms of actual wins. As I'm recording this, we just had the SAG Awards last night and the Producer Guild Awards over the weekend. It didn't win anything in either of those. It was shut out at the Golden Globes. So really, we're talking about a lot of nominations, but not a lot of wins. So I think that's really interesting going into the Academy Awards for a couple of reasons. One, because on paper, this movie felt like it was almost inevitable, it feels like it's underperforming a bit. However, this is the Academy. The Academy always does things a little bit different than anything else. So the question is, do we think it is dead in the water in terms of some of these awards? Could it go home empty-handed? I think of the three movies nominated for the most awards, Joker, 1917, and The Irishman, I think oddly this is the one that seems to have the least amount of momentum and is maybe most in danger of walking home empty-handed. The two people that have gotten the most awards in the season from The Irishman are its editor, Thelma Shoemaker, and the screenwriter, Steve Zaillian, which, again, in a movie featuring, directed by Scorsese, featuring De Niro, Pacino, and Pesci, they're not the ones getting the awards. It's the editing and the writing. Both, I think, well-deserved, mind you. So it's interesting, and I think there are two schools of thoughts when we're talking about it as a Best Picture contender. The first would say, well, this feels like an old Hollywood picture. It's a three-hour-plus epic with some of the biggest names in Hollywood doing some great work and hearkening back to a time in a period of the 60s that I think a lot of the older Academy Award voters kind of remember with some fondness. Scorsese's clearly well-regarded and beloved within the industry, so you have all of those things, and you're like, oh, this kind of feels like a no-brainer. It's also the oldest cast, maybe by a wide shot, and certainly the whitest cast, which when you're talking about the Academy Awards is kind of still its thing. So if you're looking at what's the movie that old white dudes are going to vote for, Irishman's probably at the top of that list. However, on the other side, you look at its competition. You have 1917, this big war epic, which certainly plays into voters' preferences. You have a movie like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which does the same thing about that same era, but it's also about Hollywood, and it's more of a tribute to that time period rather than maybe a critique of that time period. So you have that. Also, it is fair to point out that while we talk a lot about Scorsese being this acclaimed director, and he certainly is, I think he's one of the greatest American filmmakers of all time, when it comes to Academy Awards, he's historically come up rather empty-handed. He's only won one Best Picture and one Best Director, the same movie, The Departed. So all of his other classic movies, Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, Goodfellas, all of those movies don't end up going home with a lot of Academy Awards. So you could say, well, maybe, you know, his tastes or the movies he makes don't really ring true with Academy voters, and that might be the case. Personally, I would love to see it win some awards. I personally thought Robert De Niro should have gotten nominated. You'll hear us talk and gush over him in the proper part of the episode. But I think in terms of what I think it's got a shot to win, I think it is a contender for Best Picture. I'm not going to count it out just yet, particularly with the tiered voting system that you have. I think it may not be a lot of people's first choice, but I can't imagine it being anywhere out of the top three for people, which depending on what those others are, it could sneak in with a surprise Best Picture win. I don't think Martin Scorsese is going to win Best Director. I think it does have a chance for Adapted Screenplay, and it does have a chance for Best Editing. I also wouldn't be too surprised if I saw it win for its visual effects, because a lot was made about the de-aging technology. I know people will laugh at that, but as I said on Pop Culture Draft Night when I drafted The Irishman, that, you know, using visual effects to enhance a prestige movie maybe sit well with certain voters who maybe don't want to give another trophy to Star Wars or Marvel or whatever. So those are kind of my thoughts, but I do think if I were a betting man, I would say it's probably maybe only going to walk away with maybe with one, maybe two awards that night, which I think is kind of a bummer, but I do think it speaks to how stacked this year is, because I think it's a great film, but I think there's a lot of other really worthy films out there. So hopefully close to time, you'll get my ballot as I fill it out for my best pictures. You'll figure out where The Irishman stands. And also, one last reminder before we get into the proper episode, to go to our Facebook page so you can learn all about our Oscar party. We did it last year. We're doing it again this year at the Hoagland Center for the Arts in Springfield. Make sure you check that out if you're in the Springfield area. I may or may not be there, but I know a lot of the Front Row regulars are. Sounds like it's going to be as much, if not more fun than it was last year. So keep dialed in for that. In the meantime, hope you enjoyed this full disclosure Oscar spotlight of Martin Scorsese's The Irishman. There in podcast land, and welcome back to the Front Row Network of Podcasts, the podcast for people who actually like movies. And welcome to an episode of Full Disclosure, where we take a deep dive into the hottest new releases. I wanted to say in theaters, but this movie is not in theaters. It is on Netflix. So wherever you watch movies, it's what's going on right now. And we're talking about the movie I think a lot of people are talking about. It's award season. It's getting a lot of buzz. It's getting a lot of acclaim. It's getting some talk for other reasons as well. We're going to talk about Martin Scorsese's The Irishman. And to join me on this quest, I guarantee you we will not talk for 3.5 hours, but to talk, to break it all down with me, first and foremost, a regular contributor to the Front Row Network, please welcome back Aaron McCabe. How's it going, Aaron?
Hey, it's great, and I am so excited to talk about this movie and may actually cry for a third time over it.
Excellent. Excellent. More tears, the better.
That's right.
We'll just all have a nice big cry fest tonight. And also rounding out the panel tonight, the is it co-host or is it host of Flashbacks at this point, Ryan? Or
me and Scott are trying to figure it out, but we're going to do one. But either way.
Yeah, or does the show have to exist for there to be a host? Is that?
Well, actually, we're gonna have two this week. So.
Oh, boy. Okay. So. All right. Busy week, but welcome back, Ryan Lutens. How's it going, Ryan?
Thanks. Thanks for having me, guys. As much as Scorsese is awesome, this movie is his masterpiece. And I'm very excited to be talking about it.
Excellent. Okay. So if you've listened to Full Disclosure before, you know that we do a deep dive. We are very spoiler heavy. We're actually going to do a introduce a new wrinkle to the format, because we know a lot of you maybe haven't seen the movie. Maybe you haven't even finished the movie. We don't know. I don't know where you're at in your viewing experience. So what we're going to do, and we're going to try to do these for Full Disclosures here on out, is we're going to lead up with kind of a general overview of what we thought of the movie, whether we recommend that you see it. We'll give you a clear spoiler break. We'll count down so you can pause it if you're spoiler averse, if you haven't seen the movie, for you to rejoin. But we figured if you want to know what we think of the movie without being spoiled, we just kind of get that out right up front. So let me start off with Aaron. What is your quick 60-second review of The Irishman?
Oof. Like I already said, I cried a lot about it. I think The Irishman is one of the most self-aware films in how it takes an entire lifespan of relationships and looks at it through a lens of what was it? What did it cost me? Was it worth it? I thought it was super well done. And if you are looking for, yes, it's very slow moving. I think that that's something that can be an advantage or a disadvantage depending on how you like to consume your film. But I thought if you are looking for a movie, I think that if you're looking for a movie that you'd like to say after it, I've had a little bit too much to think, then I think The Irishman is definitely a movie for you.
All right. Excellent. How about you, Ryan?
Yeah. When it comes to The Irishman, Martin Scorsese is on top of his game, if not, you know, his masterpiece. The argument that Scorsese just does mob films, you know, after mob film, that's not true. I mean, he does other films. Yes, this movie is about the mob, but it is more so about a man's life. And that story of this man's life is what makes it so compelling. It's not just a mob movie. It has mob mentality, but it is a character-driven movie. And the characters that we get in this film are some of the most, they're larger than life characters. I mean, and the fact that this movie is 3 hours and a half, you could go with more time on this because, yes, it is a little slow burn in the start, but I mean, when it takes off and you're like, you're riveted. I honestly think this is, Scorsese's best. It is truly a masterpiece.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm right there with you. I love this movie. I absolutely adore this film. I'm a big Scorsese fan. He's one of my favorite directors, if not the, I think when it's all said and done, it's going to be him and Spielberg fighting it out for the title of greatest American film director. And I really think mileage varies based on your kind of just your style. You know, Scorsese makes his kind of movies. Spielberg makes his kind of movies, you know, like what you like and go with it. But I think ultimately this is what I will say about Scorsese that I don't think I can say about Spielberg is I think he's getting more thoughtful in his older age. I think he's getting he is getting deeper into his topics. And I think he is still telling really compelling stories. And this is one of, if not his best film yet. Yes, there's a lot of similarities in certain ways to Casino and Goodfellas. And, you know, obviously, yes, he is known for the mob movies. He's made other great films that have nothing to do with the mob. That's a whole separate podcast. So we can, when we talk about what people think about Martin Scorsese right now, but And because of the people involved, De Niro and Pesci are back working with Scorsese, giving career best performances. I know we're going to dive deeper into that. Al Pacino is here. He is doing a version of the Pacino that you're a little bit, that we're kind of all familiar with, but to maximum effect. And we'll break that down, I think, a little bit too. And the length is fine for me. I honestly think that, you know, I had this conversation with somebody else from the network about the length of it. And we're like, well, do you think it could it be trimmed down here or there? And I said, you know, if I'm being nitpicky, you could maybe trim 10 minutes off of it. But once you hit that 3 hour mark, to me, movies work in half hours. If a movie's going to be anywhere between 2.5 to 3 hours, who cares? It doesn't matter if it's 240 or 238. But, you know, if this movie is 305, and it's 320 once you hit the credits. So it's 320. If it's 305 versus 320, does it really matter? I don't think it does. I don't think that 15 minutes really matters one end or the other. So I that's my take on it. But I'm excited. I think if you haven't seen this movie, and if you're a little turned off by Scorsese's violence, I think this is, of all of his gangster movies, it's easily the least violent.
Yeah, I was going to say that, Lou. Also, that for anyone who is contemplating what is, has been averse to Scorsese's gangster movies, where they can kind of glorify that lifestyle, I think this one is, I mean, give this one a chance, because this is so much more reflective of that entire lifestyle that I think it's so worth watching.
You have a movie like Departed, which was Bloodbath City.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This movie doesn't even, I mean, it's barely a flicker compared to that film.
And Goodfellas glorified the Italian mobster lifestyle. And even mm-hmm. up until the end, I mean, I felt like really didn't walk away with any sort of moral responsibility, where this is going to surprise you.
Yeah, and I think the word I was thinking of is flashy when I think of some of those other movies. I also think of Casino. Casino is his flashiest gangster movie because of the Vegas setting. And I love those movies, by the way. Casino is one of my favorite movies. I think I even like it better than Goodfellas, if you know, if you put a gun to my head, pardon the expression. But there's no torture scenes in this like there are in those movies. The mob doesn't look cool in this movie.
No,
it's not a movie like where you get intoxicated. It's not a movie about somebody getting intoxicated with the lifestyle only to realize that it's bad. It's something different. We'll get into the spoilers a little bit, but I will say that if you're somebody who loves Casino and Goodfellas and The Departed, I will say it's the topic is the same, but it is a different take on it. So maybe if you go in expecting Casino, you might actually be disappointed by this movie in that regard. So I think that's maybe important to know if you're, you know, still saying, oh, you know, if you hadn't made the time and you're wondering to see it. But for me, that made the movie work so much better because I love those movies and have seen them enough that to have that this kind of different take, and we'll get into it when we get to spoilers, I think is great.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Before we get into the spoilers, I want to address one issue. And I know because there's been a lot of discussion about the length. I've never heard so many people talk about the length of a movie before. For the record, this is not the longest movie ever made. It's it clocks in at 3 hours and 30 minutes. It's 3:20 if you don't watch the end credits, which most people don't. So with that in mind, and there's been viewing guides as to how you should watch this movie. And obviously every movie should be seen from start to finish if you can. With that in mind, do you, Aaron and Ryan, I guess I'll open it up. Did you see any, without getting into spoilers, any specific breaks, or how much do you think you could watch this movie? How selectively could you watch this movie with still without losing some of the narrative pace of the movie?
So, you know, I think this conversation about time has coming up since it was released to a streaming platform first without actually a movie theater. You go to a movie theater, you know, you're locked into that physical place for however long. However, now you've got streaming platforms where people, especially with kids or busy lifestyles, you know, you pop on Netflix or Amazon Prime and you watch. So I think that's probably what's generating so much talk. For me, I definitely had to consume it with the, first of all, I can barely make it past 9 p.m. So I needed to be able to find a way to break it down. And what actually worked for me was I did it in two parts and I stopped it at about an hour 47. And that was based on the guide that was posted on Twitter within the network that maybe somehow we can put in the show notes or do something where to show it how to break down. But that the two-parter worked for me.
Okay. How about you, Ryan?
You know, I have a newborn. Well, I shouldn't say newborn. He's 4 months old. And so I told myself that I was going to watch this movie all the way through because that's the way Scorsese wanted it done.
Right.
But again, like you alluded to, Aaron, this is a movie that was released on a streaming platform, and you know, people are going to view at their leisure. But this is a cinematic masterpiece that, you know, you need to watch in one sitting because that's the way it's meant to be done. you know, and having a 4 month old, it was definitely difficult, but I just picked a night and said, this is when I'm going to watch it. And I powered through it. The next day I was very tired, but you know, it's just that mentality you have to have. I mean, this is a movie that you need to watch in one sitting for you to get your, I don't want to say full value, but I mean, for it to mean something, I mean, I guess I could see it both ways, because if you split it up, you're still going to get the same thing, but I guess messages stick with you more. I don't know, Aaron, you said you had cried at the end, but I don't know. I felt different watching it all the way through as opposed to splitting it up, because I don't know, it just stuck with me more. I don't know. Mm-hmm.
I feel a lot of feelings, so don't feel like you missed out because you didn't cry at the end like I did.
Yeah, I think to me, I was fortunate enough to have a day off where I was able to watch it uninterrupted. And obviously that is clearly the peak way to watch any movie. Not just this movie, any movie you want to watch, because you want to see the story and how it builds and how it unfolds. This movie, because it is about the passage of time, I do think that ending is more impactful if you are able to spend that time focused with those characters and not watch it in bits and pieces. I do think that that ending would be far less impactful if I watched this over the span of, say, a couple of days. Yep. Or if I broke it out into 5, 6, 7 pieces. I would say the one thing that I thought of, because my wife is interested in the film, and there is no way she's sitting through a 3.5-hour film. it's just not happening. And we don't have time for that. So the theory that I'm going to try, and so I'll recommend this to the listeners, is it does feel like there are two kind of clear, shifts in the story. And the first occurs when Al Pacino's character shows up. And I think the second one happens almost right about the time that Joe Pesci's character kind of re-enters. Because that's another interesting thing, and we'll talk, that's not too much, too spoilery, just to say that Pesci's in a lot of the first third of the film, Pacino's in a lot of the second, and then the third kind of has both of them. So to me, I think if you broke it up, I don't know what that equates to time-wise, but a little three-part, because it is kind of a 3-act structure. You could do Act 1, Act 2, and Act 3. That's my recommendation. I don't know if it works yet because I haven't tried it, but I was thinking in that mindset of, say, okay, if I wanted somebody to see this who just didn't have time to sit through for 3.5 hours, how would I break it up? And I think that's what I would say.
I would see that, like, you're exactly right, Lou. I would see it as like a 3-act play. That's, I mean, the way you described it was perfect. I mean, right when Pacino gets involved, then you have the middle part of the movie, and then right when Pesci comes back in the picture. It's literally a 3-act play, and it's told beautifully. So,
and I cut it off almost exactly in the middle, which was right, and this isn't spoilery either, but when Joey the Blonde enters. And that was, like I said, hour 47. And really, by leaving it off there, I thought it didn't fragment it at all, and it left me wanting to come back to it and finish the rest of the story.
Good. Okay. So with that in mind, I think we're all on board with the recommendation. So definitely, if you haven't seen The Irishman, check it out now, and pause it, because now we're about to get into spoilers. So if you are spoiler averse, now's the time to pause it. Go watch The Irishman. Take however long you need to take to watch it. Use our recommendations or don't, whatever. But we are now getting into the full disclosure part, where we're going to talk about spoilers. So we're going to go full spoilers in 3, 2, 1. All right. Yes, Jimmy Hoffa does die.
I thought he was on vacation.
Bombshell. Yeah. He's hanging out with Tupac somewhere.
Oh my God. On an island.
On an island. Him, Elvis, Tupac. They're just chilling. Anyway. Yeah. But yeah, no. Okay. So let's kind of dive into some of the points that we brought up. Aaron, I think you brought it up at the beginning about the relationship. So I want to open it up to you, because obviously this movie really emotionally affected you. So, let's start from there. And I think that's going to dovetail into a lot of sidebars. Mm-hmm. What was it about The Irishman that really moved you in that way?
Aaron, before you get started, I just want to make sure you have tissues handy.
Don't worry, I've got a lot of material in my shirt that I'll be able to wipe my nose on. Oh man. I mean, it's no joke. I feel a lot of feelings. And Martin Scorsese as a filmmaker, my first experience with him where I felt like I was like, oh my God, felt a lot of, he pulled a lot of emotion out of me in a movie was The Departed. I was so stressed out the entire time I watched that movie. Like I remember literally, I think I posted on Facebook, like, I need a Xanax. I need a Xanax watching this movie. Does anyone else feel like that? So I wasn't shocked to watch this movie. And because of the runtime and it like the slow pace of the movie, I felt like by the time it got to about 45 minutes to the end, when Robert De Niro starts to see the writing on the wall with where he, like,
you can't get out of it.
He can't get out of it. You can't get out of it. You can't get out of the emotions. The pit started growing in my stomach. And I just remember thinking, like, what a fantastic director that he's led me down the story with these characters in a movie, like we've already said, is not flashy. You could, I don't want to say it's boring, but like there's not a lot of flash. There's not a lot of excitement. And you just watch these people grow in relationships in this very innocuous way. Even though it takes place in the mob and, but then you're forced to watch them make choices in their relationship and then all the way up until the end of their life. And then have Robert De Niro's character look back and say, was this worth it? And it looked like it sure as hell wasn't. Mm-hmm. And he knew it. And you had to sit in it for like 45 minutes. So the fact that he brought you to this uncomfortable place, reflecting on your mortality, reflecting on your life choices, on the relationships you chose to put all of your time, effort, and, you know, quote unquote, blood, sweat, and tears into, was it the right relationships?
Mm-hmm. Well, and I love that idea too, because, and this is where I would part company immediately with anybody who says, oh, this is just Scorsese, you know, this is paint by numbers, mob movie stuff. It's not, I don't think it is in the least, because in all of those movies, the lesson is learned because the empire crumbles, right? In Goodfellas, it's because they get in trouble and Ray Liotta chooses to rat everybody out because he doesn't have any choice. In Casino, the empire falls. In Departed, everything falls. Like, they run a very, all of these people are successful. They go, like, and even what I love about it is they make the point of, yeah, this guy went to jail for a little bit. I went to jail for a little bit. This guy did his time. That guy did his time. Yada, yada, yada. Like they're yada, yada, the parts that in most mob movies would be the, oh, shake my finger at the camera. Crime doesn't pay, kids. In this case, like it did in that regard. But the punishment is that he is, by the end of the film, he is completely isolated. The people that he should have cared about the most don't come to visit him. Pesci's dead. Pacino's dead. Everybody's dead. And he's just left in this just kind of like depressing existence.
Oh my God.
This is what I was alluding to. This is a character driven movie.
Yeah.
It is not a mob movie. This is legitimately one person's life story and his relationship, as Aaron alluded to. The relationship with his family, the relationship with his family or his friends, with the mob, with the union. I mean, it is a straight story about this guy's life, and be driven by Robert De Niro. It's inspiring to watch. I mean, probably De Niro's best performance, but it is a character driven movie, and it is, you don't even, I mean, yeah, you're watching a mob movie, but you're watching the mob movie through somebody's eyes and their experiences. And I don't think we've ever really gotten that from Scorsese. We've got straightforward mob movies like Goodfellas and Casino and Departed, but this is someone's experience as they're living their life. I mean, you know, with those other movies, we just get snapshots. This is someone's life as he's experiencing it.
Right. And all of those other mob movies, all of those other Scorsese movies are really fixated on the minutiae of the jobs.
Yep.
You know, like you think in Casino where it's like so and so, you know, the dealer's watching the customer and the pit boss is watching this, and they break down and they break down like the money laundering scheme in Casino, yes. and they break down like in Goodfellas the machinations of how they do their job. It's all of those are very interested in how the mob functions and giving you insight into that world. This movie's not interested in that. This movie's like the mob's here, but we're not like spending all this time learning how the mob works. Like this, as you pointed out, Ryan, it's far more interested in the relationships between the characters that just the backdrop. It reminds me of like Rocky, where yes, Rocky's about boxing, but it's, you know, boxing is the backdrop to the relationship between the characters. And that's what I felt watching this movie, that this is not a movie about how the mob works. It's a, you know, it's about how these characters, you know, grow and change and, you know, connect over time. And then because they're in the mob, how that forces them to confront one another or part company, as we'll get into, I think.
So I think what you're saying is that had stuck out to me before. So I'm going to mention that is exactly, it's all about the characters' relationships. And the entire movie, even though you can say it's a mob movie, it's like the mob is kind of running in the background.
It's a backdrop.
It is a backdrop. It's running in the background almost to the point that Robert De Niro's character, Frank Sheehan, like thinks like it's in the background to him until it's brought back to the forefront. Like, no, actually the mob owns you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Don't forget. Yeah, exactly. Cause yeah, you know, he spends so much time with Hoffa that eventually when, you know, so I guess if for those who haven't seen the movie and are still listening to us about, you know, who don't really care about spoilers. So the first third of the film is really concerned about the Pesci De Niro relationship. And then Jimmy Hoffa is introduced and De Niro's character, Frank Sheehan, goes to work for Jimmy Hoffa and they form a very good relationship. They form a rapport and to the point where he becomes Jimmy Hoffa's right-hand man. And then Pesci's character re-enters the film and is like, cause Hoffa is kind of getting a little too out of control in the mob. His relationship with the mob is strained. And as that relationship strained, De Niro finds himself in the middle between these two. Yep. See, like what you said, Aaron, they're like, don't forget who, you know, why you're there in the first place. Right. And don't forget the guy, Pesci's character, who is interest, you know, who is the reason De Niro's even there in the first place.
Mm-hmm. You know, and it's like, you know, it's like Aaron said, it's just the backdrop. I mean, you have Frank Sheehan and he's just living his life as a truck driver. And then he gets involved with Joe Pesci, who's the part of the Bellafano crime family, Buffalino. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Crime family. And then he starts to do more jobs for them. And it's almost like he's starting to become a made man. But all the while you're learning about his family and how he's doing jobs, not for the mob per se, but he's doing it influenced by the mob, so to speak, and how he's making contacts. So it's really an evolution of his character as that progression goes on. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And that's where, to me, the biggest takeaway that I had from the film was and this is the other part of it too, is because again, there's familiarity because yes, Joe Pesci and Robert De Niro, yes, again, in another mob movie directed by Martin Scorsese. But both of those these actors are doing something they have never done in either of those previous films or, and I would argue in any of the films they've done, mm-hmm. you know, I, the last time I could think about De Niro showing this much vulnerability, honestly, was Awakening.
Oh God.
Yeah, you know?
Yeah.
And so that is, you know, he is normally he's the heavy, he's this imposing figure and De Niro himself is always, you know, kind of this imposing presence and to see him have to like, basically he's the middleman and he's always like, he's never in charge of anything.
No, he's always kind of trying to placate the other side and yeah.
His range in this movie is just unbelievably good. Anyway, we'll get to that when we talk about awards and everything. So
yeah, but so he's absolutely just caught in between these, and mm-hmm. his emotions are challenged by his relationship with Joe Pesci, and then his with Russell and his relationship with Hoffa, and you know you can see the taxing that it has on him. And then when you add in the relationship with his family, which I know we're going to get into Anna Paquin and her role in the film. And then in the final act, when everybody's dead but him, everybody's dead but Frank, and him just sitting there like no one's coming to alone. And his family's alive. You know that his wife has died, but his kids don't come visit him. And all of that sort of stuff. It's just like, what was it worth? You know, it didn't matter, like, ultimately. And to me, that was one of the things of takeaways from the film is Scorsese just kind of talking about, like, you know, you could apply the life lesson of the Irishman to just about any, you know, to anybody, you know, getting wrapped up in certain relationships, getting wrapped up in your work, getting wrapped up in shit that doesn't really matter. To you know, at the end of the day, everybody dies, everybody goes away, regardless of how successful you were at your job or whatever. And what's left for you in those final years?
Yeah,
that final scene with him sitting in his wheelchair, and it closes out with just him sitting there. I mean, it's such a powerful closer. You know, here's a guy that lived a very big life, huge, you know, and possibly holds the biggest secret in American history. What happened to Jimmy Hoffa? Jimmy Fonda.
Who is Jimmy Fonda, by the way?
Right. That, I don't know.
Were you thinking Jane Fonda?
Yes. It's a little bit of both.
Were you thinking Peter Fonda? Or
I'm going to have another drink of beer.
what did ever happen to Peter Fonda? I want a full investigation.
Only Frank Sheeran knows.
Right. But the fact that he's sitting there and he's got family that's still alive, and he lived this big life. You know, he even had a decent professional life. Like, he was a Teamster and he was being honored by the unions. And he's sitting there about to die, utterly alone. And you feel that as the movie is closing. That's what makes this movie so good, is you feel that through Robert De Niro.
Mm-hmm. It was haunting.
Yeah.
I'm actually feeling the pit, like, come back into my stomach as we talk about it. It was haunting that his last words, that Robert De Niro's last words in that scene while he's sitting alone after all of this were, "Oh, it's Christmas today." That was the last thing he said. And then, right, they shoot him just there by himself alone. And I mean, for me, I'd lay down and go cry. There were a lot of feelings, but right, like, oh my God, like, yeah, that was it. Is it Christmas?
Well, and that again speaks to one of the things that I think makes this movie different than the other Scorsese movies, or at least his other, I should say his previous mob trilogy.
Yeah.
Is that there's a, I don't want to say nihilism to them. I would say there is this frankness to them, to the point where everybody who's doing these things knows what they've gotten themselves into. So when they are punished or when they are killed or tortured or whatever, you're not really meant to feel that bad for them. Like, you're not meant to feel bad for really anybody in those movies, of the main characters, at least. And in this one, you are meant to, clearly, Scorsese wants you to, by the end of it, feel sympathy for Frank. And you do to a certain degree, and it's the first time I'm with you, Aaron. I cried at the end of the film, and this is obviously, I never cried during any of those other films.
Right.
I think that speaks to the emotional ties that he builds throughout the film, that you're like, okay, he's not a, Frank himself's not that bad of a guy, at least in the context of, you know, other mob films that we've seen.
He is a victim of circumstance. You know, it's, you know, he's just living his life. He got involved and he really has no option because, I mean, he ultimately owes his allegiance to Joe Pesci's Russell. And in the end, that's what it boiled down to. But at what cost? Everything.
Yeah. And I don't know that I'd say for me, he's a victim of circumstance, but I think that it's very easy in these movies, like Lou has said, it's very easy in movies that are obviously portraying crime to very much write off anything human about these human characters.
Yeah.
To just be like, oh, he's a jerk or he's a bad person and he's awful and he's evil and whatever. But they, Scorsese put in so much effort to develop the humanity of each of these characters, of Russell Bufalino, of Frank Sheeran, of Jimmy Hoffa, in a way that it created such a conflict. You were not in a, you as a viewer are not in a position to very easily wave off and go, well, he was a jerk. You know what I mean? Like that, right. What was so powerful about it.
Let me clarify by what I meant. It's, you know, he chose the mob life in the beginning. Yeah. He made those killings. He was a hitman. But for Russell, aka Joe Pesci, to not give him any choice about how to handle the Hoffa situation, that was a victim of circumstance. He's with somebody that he cares about. That's in that moment, he was the victim of circumstance, you know,
probably
his closest friend. And I'm just going to spoil it right here. He is ordered by Joe Pesci to kill Jimmy Hoffa. And he does, you know, somebody that he grew really, really close to. And in that moment, because he owed allegiance to Russell, he had to do it. And that's where the victim of circumstance. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was not necessarily that Russell was a better friend. It was in that moment, he realized he's owned by the mob.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. He wouldn't have been where he was he wouldn't have known who Hoffa was if it wasn't for Russell.
Right.
And he wouldn't be alive if it wasn't for Russell. Because we see that scene in the beginning where Russell, you know, sticks his neck out for him in the very beginning. And you know, it's like, okay, this guy's done something for you. And they build that, you know, kind of that relationship. You know, and it's helped, we'll circle back to this when we talk about criticisms of the film, but it's also helped by the fact that it's De Niro and Pesci who we've seen interact with each other so much on screen. And there's such a natural rapport and chemistry with the two of them that it's like, oh yeah. Like, and to me, I push back on this movie, I could point out a moment where the film lagged. But it wasn't until like, you know, probably 2.5 hours in for me. But to me, all of that initial, I didn't find the movie slow to start because there was something just so cool and fun about seeing De Niro and Pesci together on screen again.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was like, oh my gosh, these guys are back. And you haven't seen Joe Pesci in forever. And so it was like, oh, Joe Pesci's back. De Niro is, you know, back doing, you know, a quality film, which hasn't happened in a very long time. Mm-hmm. And so from my movie fan mind, like was having enough fun with that concept that maybe that got me past the slower world building that happens in the first third of the film. I don't know, but mm-hmm. I still found what they were doing really riveting. But the other part that I wanted to, I wanted to bring up about Frank and one of the reasons I think we're sympathetic to him is he kills a lot of people, but we never actually see him kill anybody on screen other than Jimmy Hoffa. Am I right?
No, there's the one where he's walking around the corner.
Oh, okay. There's that one. But even
there's
then it's like
two people.
There's like
two,
but they're done more in like these wide shots.
Yep.
Yeah.
So we're
and they're
never,
quick.
They're quick. They're so brief. That's where, again, the lack of violence in the film actually works to its benefit because we're not watching him torture anybody. We're not seeing the look on his face when he kills anybody. So we don't know if he revels in it, if he gets any joy out of it. We just see it. It's matter of fact. And it's not so pushed in our face that we, you know, kind of as you, the word you use, Aaron, is we dehumanize Frank at all. It allows us to stay connected to him in a way that a lot of those other mob movies don't, because we see a lot of those lead characters do brutal things. And so because of that, we're still able to connect with him.
Well, and I think that that's also what complicates it, to your point with Russell, is that Joe Pesci comes back into the limelight in this role where I don't think he raises his voice once.
Nope. No,
not once. He is this very calm, cool, collected, sometimes intense, but he's this very steady character, very easy to get along with, very easy. You know, he's shown in his community to be very giving, this, that, and the other. It's not the Joe Pesci that you know in a mob movie. And I think that's the other reason why, even for him and to watch it, it's like, you're not given reasons to like necessarily super dislike this guy. Like mm-hmm. even when he's trying to explain, to not explain, but like comfort Robert De Niro's character when he tells him he's going to go and he's going to kill Jimmy Hoffa. He's still trying to comfort him as a friend. And he's like, you knew it had to be this way. I did it to save you. Like this movie was kind of a mind F. I know this is going on, I'm not gonna swear, but like in that way, it was really messing with me.
Yeah. I agree with you. And that's, yeah, because it's using there's human emotions that are going on that are built over time. And mm-hmm. you know that as the span of this movie goes on, that, you know, those bonds, you know, deepen, and it's, you know, it's friendship. And yeah. it's one of, you know, like when you're the friends that you have when you're in high school or college, you know, 20, 30, 40 years down the road, even if you don't always see them or always talk to them, the mm-hmm. connection runs so deep that, yeah, you're still always going to be drawn back to that person. And it's complicated further by when you owe somebody, you know, that something that yeah. is as much as Frank owes Russell in this film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So let's segue then a little bit. And so we started by how that last scene just opens up a lot of different paths to us. But let's open it up to a couple of other scenes before we move on to performances that really stood out to you. Aaron, since you brought up the last scene, I'll let you start, Ryan. What's a scene that you really wanted to make sure we talk about?
The scene that I want to talk about, I think in essence is what this movie is all about is, the Some People scene. It's during Frank's, they're honoring Frank, and it's when Russell re-enters the picture. And it's right when you know that things are going wrong. And the reason why I like this scene so much is because there is that scene, I mean, between Joe Pesci, Russell, and Al Pacino's Jimmy Hoffa, not Fonda. But they're sitting and talking, and it's, you know, they're trying to have a civil conversation, but it just, there's that undertone of malevolence right around the corner. And, you know, Joe Pesci just keeps saying, some people, and Al Pacino wants answers. And that's when we know that it's going to, something's going to go wrong. And it does. But before this whole scene, this whole dinner party scene, looks are worth 1,000 words. Al Pacino looking at Joe Pesci while he's eating his food. I mean, that just, mm-hmm. that it stops trains. Robert De Niro watching these two friends have this conversation when he knows that the outcome is not going to be good. I mean, this happens right before the house of cards starts tumbling. And I think that really sets up the climax of this film. And that's what makes it so powerful.
So. Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. I think that's a great scene. And there's the, you know, this is, I think, the first time we've ever gotten Pacino and Joe Pesci on yes. screen together, correct?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so there's that kind of fun to it. You know, so again, it, like the meta movie nerd in me is like, oh, this is, you know, this, how cool is this? That, like, we're getting a scene like these guys together. But then to see that you're right, the context of what the characters are trying to do, and they know what's going on. And
yeah, yeah. The undertone is just crazy. It's mm-hmm. nuts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For me, one of the scenes that I really like, and this maybe we'll segue into the performances. So obviously the trio that we're talking about, Frank and Hoffa and Russell, so De Niro and Pacino and Pesci are the driving force. There is this kind of almost like second tier villain in the film. And called Tony Pro,
Stephen Graham,
and yeah, who is great in the film. I yep. think he holds his own 100% in the movie. But the scene where, so you know, a lot of the second act is Hoffa losing grip of his role on the Teamsters, and Tony Pro is kind of this up and comer who we never really like. He's clearly like a puppet. He is so obviously like
yeah.
guy one to not take seriously.
Yeah. But he's real serious.
But he thinks he's very serious. He thinks he's mm-hmm. a very big deal. But like we, like as an audience, I don't think we're ever meant to take him very seriously. And Hoffa knows that he shouldn't be like, he shouldn't have to take him seriously. But the scene that the two of them have where Tony Pro shows up in shorts.
Like and a white shirt.
Yeah, and makes him, and is late, is intentional. It's like these subtle mind games, and it's like Hoffa kind of having to debase himself a little bit because he is so desperate to stay, to get his kingdom back, to get his empire back. And he hears this just jabroni, like that he has to just kind of, whose ass he has to kiss. That's the other great part about it is no one in this movie is like a kingpin.
Yeah.
You know, in these other movies where they're like, oh, all of these guys are so freaking cool. They control everybody. They own everybody. Everybody like bends the knee to them. That doesn't happen in this movie at all.
No.
Jimmy Hoffa's here like kissing the ass of just a mook. Like just this absolute mm-hmm. schlub of a dude. And like, and so I love that scene because like Pacino's just on another level in that scene, and Stephen Graham's like right there with him because earlier they have they're in prison at the same time. It's one of the funniest moments in the movie
where
over ice cream they have a fight in prison with each other, and it's just so great. And so I thought that was a great encapsulation of how no one in this, again, it is a subversion of what we come to expect from mob movies, where it's always the rise of the empire. How cool is the empire? Oh, the mm-hmm. movie's got to end. So I guess they're going to get busted and then the movie ends. Right.
Yep.
But this movie like revels in those moments where they're not cool.
Go ahead, Aaron.
I was just going to say, I mean, literally, I think from almost the beginning of the movie until the end, they do those little freeze frames where you've got a person who is in the mob and it lists their name. How they died. And at first I couldn't figure out why they were doing that. I was like, what does this mean? Where is this going? And then I think I finally realized like it was, again, it just kind of tied into the whole, like, look at all these people who died. Like, what was it? Yeah. Like they all died except for the one guy that they freeze framed over and they were like, lived till old age, was well-liked by everybody.
Everyone's just kicking
each other off. Sorry.
That's fine. Lou, what I want to say is during that scene, Stephen Graham actually ad-libbed a line, and it was the very last line that caused Al Pacino to get up and strangle him. And I read an article that said that Al Pacino thought that was the greatest ad-lib line he's ever... I mean, just the chemistry between those two in that scene was just so tense and yet so funny. It was just mm-hmm. remarkably filmed.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And they're so connected in that way it's great. And yeah, to your point, Aaron, where they're talking about, you know, yeah, again, it's the other idea of everybody just dies. Everybody goes away at some point.
Yeah.
None of these people, like the empire is what it is. All of these people think they're so cool and they think that they rule the world. Most of them die unceremoniously. And that's the other part about it is nobody gets a glorious death in this film.
No.
You know? And, you know, even the scene where I guess we should, let's talk about the two death scenes of the three main characters. Cause we don't see Frank die, but we do get to see, and we don't specifically see Russell die, mm-hmm. where the movie starts to become heartbreaking. And it's such a fine scene is the last time we see Russell's character, where mm-hmm. Russell and Frank are in prison together. Russell's had a stroke. And so Pesci is doing that scene in a wheelchair with like the loss of half of his body. And he's trembling. And he is so, again, it's heartbreaking to see, but Pesci is so good in that. And they just wheel him off. He's going to mass. They wheel him off. We never see him again. Right.
Yeah.
He doesn't get this like grand send off. He doesn't get this like warrior's death. He doesn't get anything that like typifies what a guy like him, a way a guy like him, we are conditioned as movie fans to go out like. Right.
Yeah.
And then with the Hoffa death, we don't get a moment like other directors in a worse film. we would turn around, Hoffa would turn around, see the gun, they would lock eyes together, and then he would shoot. Right? Yep. We would see, because some director would be like, oh, we got to get that moment that where he realized that connection where he realizes he's been got.
Yep.
Yeah.
And Hoffa never realizes he's been got.
Yep.
Yes.
And then, yeah, so his death, completely unceremonious. It was, oh, he got in trouble. He got whisked into this house, and without being known, he just got shot in the back of the head. And because we don't see Pacino actually get shot, because the way the shot is framed, it's around the corner. So we see the gun go off. We see the blood splat. That's it. Again, unceremonious stuff. And just to say, okay, it's a far cry from Pacino and Scarface, you know, going out just like, you know, the king of the world.
You know, going along with what Aaron said about seeing like the captions on how people died, I think it's almost ironic. Because, you know, these are mobsters that we know how they died, you know, shot 6 times in the face. I think that was literally one of them. But, you know, we don't get that for Hoffa. Like, and I think it's almost like a play on the content, because, you know, Frank Sheeran came out and said, yeah, I killed Hoffa, but we don't know if that's true. So I think that's almost like, you know, an idea of, you know, we don't know the real truth. And that's kind of the irony of the movie.
And in the real world, that's been disputed and almost like straight up debunked. This guy claims to have killed Jimmy Hoffa. And this is based on a book called I Heard You Paint Houses.
Yeah.
Which is why that Chiron comes up. Because somebody brought this up in another podcast, so I won't claim this is a great idea, but I think you really wanted to call that movie, I Heard You Paint Houses.
I think it originally was called that.
But it didn't, you know, it doesn't have the same ring to it as The Irishman, you know, I know, like, and so this guy, you know, Frank Sheeran has claimed to kill Jimmy Hoffa, but there's a lot of detectives and police analysts, people who have been on that case for years, to say that is totally implausible, that it's most likely he didn't kill Hoffa, but we don't really know. So we're kind of allowed to think this, to the point of maybe this is how Hoffa died. Who knows?
Right.
And I think it's interesting that, like you're saying, all of these gangsters who led these celebrity like lives and had all this control, because the whole movie shows you how much control the mob actually has in politics, in the labor force, in Vegas, in financial ventures, all of this stuff, right? And almost nobody would be able to tell you all of those mobsters' names. But everybody knows Jimmy Hoffa's name.
Yep.
He's the only one who's kind of carried on. I mean, like the mob in general carries on a legacy, but like Jimmy Hoffa, who went the entire movie never believing he was actually owned by the mob, but he was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's really got the only name that still people know.
Yeah. Right? It's in a lot of that way. He's in the culture. Like you know, his disappearance has become like a punchline. It's like, oh, we're going to put you where they put Jimmy Hoffa, you know?
Yeah. And yeah.
Like, it's so, it's kind of this very grim, like, it's one of the grimmest, like, shared jokes we have as a culture is that.
Oh my God. Yes.
You know, similar, you know, I made it earlier with him and Tupac, but it's like, you know, it's just in that moment. So it's playing on a, you know, a character who obviously, a historical character, a real life person that a lot of people have not knowledge of. That was interesting to watch. I thought that was another really great strength of the film, is that it is, while it's not necessarily a quote unquote true story, it's inspired by real events, and it's capturing a moment in America's history where you really did get to see how much the mob allegedly had rooted themselves into American politics, and how much really they controlled, because the theory of this movie is that, you know, JFK's only there because of
the mob.
Yeah.
And as somebody, I think you and Aaron, you and I chatted about this a while back. I didn't grow up in that time period, but I grew up in a household of Kennedy Democrats and major labor supporters. Yes. And I guess I didn't understand or realize really how at odds Jimmy Hoffa and the Kennedys were. at that point. And this is a work of fiction. I don't want to take this for reality, but to know that that at least friction existed was kind of a mini revelation for me, but it leads to a great scene.
Yeah.
Well, my understanding is that Joe Kennedy did have known ties to the mob. Mm-hmm. Like that was a historical fact, but yeah, I grew up in a, my dad's side of the family is Italian, and we used to go for feast days, you know, for like big parades where everyone's wearing white and they're carrying, you know, Our Lady of Mount Carmel and you're kissing the statue. And we'd have big barbecues and everyone would sit down in the house. Like they'd sit the kids down and be like, okay, you guys are watching Goodfellas. You know, and like, and after that, it's The Godfather. Like, this is what we do. Like, so yes, mob culture has been something that like, and it was glorified. Like all the kids, the Italian boys wanted to be Joe Pesci, mm-hmm. you know, and this deconstructs it.
Right. Right. And that's, again, to put a button on that part about it is, yeah, to say that there is, you know, I think Scorsese in his own way is kind of reckoning with the impact some of his films have had. Mm-hmm. Because as you pointed out, like nobody should want to be Joe Pesci in any film. Most of his films, maybe My Cousin Vinny. Maybe. Right?
Like, you got to pick one.
If you got to pick one, I'll go with Vinny Gambino. Like he's, you know, yeah. he's a good. He's,
I was thinking 8 heads in a duffel bag.
Go, oh, stop it. Delete your account. You're not even. But yeah, like, you know, but the fact that the mob has looked so cool in so many films, many of them directed by Martin Scorsese, that yeah. he's like, okay, before I go, before I'm done, I got to make one more movie to make sure that we demystify what we know as the mob. Because when we all think the mob, we think of, yeah, cool looking suits, guns, money, parties, paying off right. people, getting away with stuff. And it's really yeah. like any other industry where there's yeah. infighting and it's, you know, a grind in many ways, and it's a job, and I love that. So yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because I think there's the demystifying of the myth of the American mob, I think, is front and center in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
But let's start talking about performances. We can come back to scenes in a little bit, but obviously we've talked a little bit about De Niro, but let's focus on our first on our three leads, and then we'll get out to the supporting characters. Is there anything that we want to say more about De Niro before we move on? Because I don't think we've talked a lot about Pesci or Pacino yet.
De Niro's being robbed right now. The fact that he hasn't gotten a Golden Globe nomination or a SAG nomination is ridiculous. This is his best movie. It's probably his best acted movie in quite a while. Like you said, Awakenings. It is highway robbery.
All right. Aaron, you got anything to add?
I would just say I loved the vulnerability that he put in the third act. I mean, he was likable, I thought, the entire time for someone who was, you know, a henchman for the mob. But the vulnerability he shows in the third act and the humanness mm-hmm. just, you know, was, oh, man, it was amazing.
The depth. I mean,
yeah.
Again, when he's on the phone with Josephine Hoffa,
yeah,
I felt for the guy. He's trying to, he stammers on his words.
Yeah.
I mean, it is probably the quintessential scene for the reason why he should be nominated. Just in that scene alone. I mean, he killed Hoffa. He's talking to his wife and he's trying to support her, but he can't because he knows that he did it. I mean, it is just watching his character rip in half at that point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He's completely the emotional center of this movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I agree with you, Ryan. I think the other two, and we'll get into Pesci and Pacino in a minute, but if I have to theorize, it's because, first of all, Pesci hasn't been in the scene for 20 years. He hasn't done a movie in almost 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And he's doing it so against type. So there's that. And again, but everybody's wonderful in this movie. I'm not diminishing that.
Yeah.
And then you have Pacino, who is doing a riff on Pacino, what we know as, and we'll talk about that because
yeah.
I want to address one of the criticisms that one of our colleagues had about him. But he's doing it in a way that works. So it's a flashier role. So you've got Pacino with the flashy role. You've got Pesci working against type. Then you have De Niro, who's kind of more this you know, middle area. And I just, I think to me, it's the best performance of the film. And because of the vulnerability that you mentioned, Aaron, it's the center of the film. If you don't think his character is vulnerable, the movie doesn't work. And the fact that it does is a credit to him. So I agree. I think he anchors the film. So let's talk Joe Pesci a little bit. I know we mentioned about him playing against type, but is there any moment or scene in particular that he has where you thought he was particularly that stood out to kind of serve that point?
For me, when he gives the ring of almost brotherhood to De Niro, it's like, you know, he's, you know, when he's giving it to him, it's like, oh, he's being a friend. But it, the subtext of like, I mean, Pesci all the way. I mean, if there's any reason why he's getting nominated, it's because of that scene. I mean, just the subtext of, hey, you're one of us now. We're a friend. But in the background, you're like, we own you. You're ours. It is just crazy good.
Listen, I was as big of a fool as Frank Sheeran was in that moment. I was like, oh, my God, they're accepting him. Like, they're all friends. And I think he was, too.
Yeah.
and then we both learned later on that that was not the case.
Yeah. Well, and I'll push back on that a little bit because I do think that, you know, I guess the question is, how much does Russell care about Frank? I think that's an interesting question.
To me, it almost seemed like a father figure, you know, like he's helping out with his car the first time you see him. Mm-hmm. And then they form that bond, a very, very strong friendship, you know, and that's where De Niro thinks he has to go to bat for Russell. You know, he'll do all these things for Russell, you know.
However.
Again. Go ahead.
However, and I see this like... Sometimes you form friendships or bonds with people that you work with. And unless you work with them, you might not actually have a friendship or a bond. And so does the bond form because they are become business partners in a sense, or were they friends? And that's, I think, Lou, to what you're talking about. It's like, well, how much does he care? And like, what came first?
That's what I was going to say. The subtext, is he just using him the whole way through?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Ugh. Yeah. And right. And that, again, that gives such a layer. That's why this movie is incredibly layered and complex in that way, because, we'll get to Pacino, but it brings up, and I think this is going to open up to this other character, is that if we go with the theory, I'm almost going with the theory that maybe Russell didn't care about Frank the way that Frank cared about Russell.
I would agree.
Because what's seen in what the through line of the movie is Russell becomes a part of Frank's life.
Yeah.
They form a friendship. Their wives are friends. You know, they bring Russell over to Christmas. That's another scene that sticks out in my mind is Russell works so hard to get Peggy, Frank's daughter's approval and love. And Peggy has none of it, ever. Like from like minute one, you know, regardless of the actor playing it, we'll get to Anna Paquin who plays older Peggy in a minute. Mm-hmm. But Peggy like dials in, and I was kind of thinking, I was like, well, why is Peggy so turned off by Russell? And I think the more that I it swirls in my brain, I think it's because Peggy sees what we don't see or what Frank doesn't see, and that Russell cares about him, but not the way that Frank thinks he cares about it.
Yeah.
I could be wrong. And maybe, you know, I don't know, but I think that like ends up going to, carries itself out to the end, because then when Hoffa is introduced to their family, Peggy takes to him instinctively.
Immediately.
Like, and that's, you know, to say, okay, well, Hoffa is, yes, Hoffa's blustery. Hoffa's, you know, a grandstander. He's got a major ego. But there might actually be more heart to him than there is Russell's character. And Peggy is maybe Scorsese's way of showing that to us. That, you know, Russell we think Russell is this kind of mentor and that caring presence, but Peggy's like, no, he's her bullshit.
Peggy sees him. Yeah. Peggy, you know, a lot of children kind of like animals too. It's like, they know him when they see him. And I did feel that element too. And especially the longer I thought about it, where it was like, Peggy could see Russell for who he was, and Frank for who he was. And I think you're right. That does help you in the end see, even maybe when Frank can't see it, that like Frank picked the wrong loyalties.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. And that gets to the performance that I think a lot of people are talking about in the most maybe controversial manner. And that is the fact that Peggy's character does not speak to the entirety of the movie until Hoffa is dead. And by then, Anna Paquin is playing the role of Peggy. And she gets, I believe it's 8 words. I'm going to hand this over to Ryan, because I know Ryan really wants to talk about it. But just to set that moment up. Yeah, he's, you know, Frank is the one who has to call Hoffa's widow and tell him what's gone on, even though he himself is the one who killed Hoffa. So he has to lie, and then that gets Anna Paquin her big moment. Go ahead, Ryan.
You know, I was talking to someone, and they said that I read an article about the misrepresentation of women in this film. This movie is about men. You know, there are women gangsters, but during this time, it was mainly men controlling the power. There are strong female performances. I mean, the two women, while Russ and Frank are going around, I mean, great performances by those two women. But something needs to be said for Anna Paquin, because she says 8 words in this movie, and I feel like she had one of the biggest impacts of this film just by her looks. Her eyes and her facial expressions are, I mean, they tell a story. When she's dancing with her father at her father's ceremony and she's looking at Russell, but in essence, the way it works out is, I mean, I just see Anna Paquin as this moral compass for Frank when he's older. But by then, his family life, it's just too late to gauge into that, because it's almost he's distanced himself. And no, he doesn't really know his daughter. That's why she doesn't speak so much. It's just because the people that he's around just doesn't want to be any part of it. So, you know, you have this moral compass in her, and he doesn't really take advantage of it. And, you know, a picture's worth 1,000 words, and a performance is the same. And the fact that she only says 8, and she is so good with her facial expressions. I mean, she is that morally good part of his life that you just want him to reach out to, and he doesn't.
Well, and he kind of waves her off, like a lot of people in that era waved off their children. Like,
when she was younger.
Yeah, kind of like, go back to bed. It's okay. Like, you're just a kid. What do you know? Like, that kind of thing. And she sees, you know, that he's got a bad streak in him. And she sees Russell for what he is. And also, I wasn't sure, but I'm thinking, like, the more that I ruminate about it, that it was by design. But I was like, gosh, like, they don't spend a whole lot of time on his family, so you don't feel very connected to his daughters, his wives, anything like that. And I think the more I thought about it, it was probably by design.
Yeah.
In that, like, that's not even where he didn't spend that most of his life with his family in those relationships. Most of his time was spent with these other two people. So it's no wonder that they get only a sliver in the film.
Yeah. And we should be mad at that.
Yeah.
You know, I know there's a lot of people that are upset, and I'm not the right person maybe to address whether or not that's sexist in any way on Scorsese's part. But I'll just say my interpretation of how the women in this movie were used, in that they are, we should have focused more on them. Frank should have focused more on them. He should have spent more time with them. And that's part of the regrets of his life, is he has that moment where he realizes that his wife has died, and he realizes his kids won't come to see him, and it's done. Or the bank scene where he goes like and tries to interact and it doesn't happen. Like, that is, it's just like, and it's a use of female characters that hasn't, again, existed in his other films. mm-hmm. in Goodfellas, Lorraine Bracco's character's right. You know, she's the moral compass of the film, and so she brings up the message.
Yep.
And in Casino, Sharon Stone's character's right in the thick of things, and she's the reason that the empire falls, which is kind of a problematic use of her character, maybe in modern times. I don't know. That's the Casino podcast. But so in this era, I think I agree. I don't mind it so much. I didn't find it like, oh, how dare he do this. I hear that.
Yeah. I didn't think it was sexist. And if you think like his other mob movies, I mean, in a lot of them, Gangs of New York, like there's a lot of prostitutes, even the moral compasses are snorting cocaine, they're using drugs. Like they're just as much as the problem. Mm-hmm. Whereas I feel like in this movie, now that we're talking about it, the women don't have a ton of screen time, but they are the most virtuous. They do stay out of all of that crap. They are the most unscathed by this lifestyle.
And he's not Frank's not choosing that life. I mean, he's
right.
He's purposely putting them on the back burner when they should be his forefront. It's that morality.
But you see Hoffa with his wife a lot. You see Hoffa's wife more than any other female in there.
Mm-hmm.
You see him with his family more than anybody.
Yeah. You're right. And I think that brings us to talk about Pacino, who I don't think we've talked a whole lot about. We've brought him up here and there, but yet as it dovetails into that, the way that Anna Paquin sees him is, I think, is the way that, or the way that Peggy sees him is the way that we should see him. And that is as kind of the most likable of these three guys, and more of a sympathetic figure. Like he has his moments where, he's an asshole and he's blustery and he's got the ego, but you know, and what I love, and this, you know, again, I'm not here to like criticize people who aren't on the podcast and can't vocalize it. But I've heard one criticism of Pacino that's been said in the of him is that he is just doing, in some scenes, he's doing his Pacino thing and he's going over the top and he's chewing the scenery. And to me, I felt as if that's using what we know of Pacino in the best way and matching it to a character where it's appropriate. I don't mind when Pacino goes over the top. I mind when he goes over the top in moments where it's not called for.
Mm.
And I think Jimmy Hoffa was a very big presence.
Yes. He was larger than life wherever he went.
Yeah. And he was theatrical. He was like, he was this charismatic kind of Pied Piper and like could whip a crowd up into a frenzy. That's why he was such an important figure in that time period. And so for Pacino to have that kind of explosiveness to him, I think it matches Hoffa's explosiveness, but it's tempered with those scenes of sensitivity and likability. And Pacino just has, Pacino maybe of the three of them, has the most like effortless charisma.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where it's like, you kind of, you still remember like 70s era Pacino, like Serpico and like Tony Montana, and like just that like you know, sex appeal that I don't know that, I mean, I don't think Pesci ever had, but that maybe De Niro maybe had, but like Pacino, like you could see why people would like him and why people would gravitate towards him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he wasn't playing Pacino. He was playing Hoffa. Mm-hmm. I mean, to Hoffa was a man of business, and that whole meeting scene, like he honestly felt like he was being disrespected. And he was, I mean, the guy shows up in a Hawaiian shirt and shorts 15 minutes late. To Hoffa, that was a slap in the face because he was professional. That's how he made his living. You know, and when you have a great actor like Al Pacino playing a charismatic person and larger than life person like Hoffa, I mean, it's perfect casting. It's what it is.
Yeah. It is. It's using it's playing to his strengths. Yep. And it's like, you know, I always balk sometimes because I know we get into this argument of, you know, oh, this person can only do this or that, or they are, they only play with things. Like you're cast for what we, you know, you're cast to fit the role. And if the role calls for it and you do that, then that's great. It's only when it's like, and Pacino's certainly done this in where he's not been, he's dialed up to 11 where it hasn't been called for or a director hasn't reined him in. But let's not forget, like, Pacino, when at his best, is one of maybe the best American actors we've ever had. I think that's, and we lose that because, you know, he got it, you know, he became Pacino with an exclamation mark, you know, somewhere in the early 90s. And we, you know, only get glimpses of the guy who was Michael Corleone in, you know, in the 70s. And so, I think I get why he's getting nominated. I get why, you know, it's a return to form for him and a return to form for De Niro, because both of them have, you know, floundered in some, you know, pretty mediocre movies for a while. Like Pacino, aside from maybe like a couple of HBO films, really hasn't, you know, hasn't done a lot. But, so before we get into criticisms, I just want to say, are there any of the supporting roles or anything that we haven't said about the performances before we move on?
I was just going to say about Pacino, the thing that really, and I think this is again why it ties in, why Peggy likes him, why what was very endearing about his character of Jimmy Hoffa is that, again, he has so much sincerity, whether he is being over the top or he's being careless, whether he's pissed and it's in that scene where he's screaming at his underlings about how they like put his wife on the roster, like near election time. And he's flipping out about that. There's sincerity and the passion for what he built. And I think that carries through the entire role up until his demise. He has those moments where he's sharing that vulnerability with Frank going, I built this. They can't take it from me. I built this. This is mine. This is always going to be mine. And he has that naive sincerity the whole way through, even up until, and that trusting, you know, they wouldn't take this from me. He's got a sense of naivete to him. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't take this from me. I've done too much for them. No, Frank, it's going to be okay. No. And even when he looks at Frank to get in the car, when he doesn't trust that, that it's safe for him to go to that meeting, and he looks in Frank's eyes and Frank has to lie to him and say, no, it's okay. And he goes, okay. And he lets his guard down and gets in the car. Up until the very end, he carries that sincerity with him the whole time. And I think that is because you're so busy thinking you're getting Pacino, you miss those human, deep human characteristics that he brings to the role.
Yeah. The moments that I love are when he's with Peggy.
Yeah.
And he's like buying her ice cream, and he's just like, he is sincere. Like, I don't think in those, you mentioned that, Aaron, he's like you don't feel like he's, it's such a stark contrast. Yeah. It's such a stark contrast to Russell, who is trying, who reeks of effort.
Right. You're 100% right, because you've hit the nail right on the head. He merely bought Peggy a sundae. Mm-hmm. But Russell's trying to give her $100. Mm-hmm. He's trying to buy her like everybody else.
Yep.
Ooh, Lou. Right.
Yeah. That's why, again, this movie has so much. I mean, we could talk about it for hours.
Yep.
And
right.
we're veering into that as it is. But yeah, I guess
I can talk small characters if you want, real quick.
Yeah, let's talk small characters. Mm-hmm. I let you have Anna Paquin, so you got to give me Ray Romano.
You can have him.
He's great.
He's in my supporting character fantasy draft. just because I want to sing Ray Romano's praises for a minute, because I like, again, you've got Robert De Niro, Al Pacino, Joe Pesci, Anna Paquin, Ray Romano. But he is, again, he's so good in this. He has his moments, you know. He's again a very supporting character. This movie is almost like 85% driven by the three main characters, so let's not like make any too much about it. But like, I just thought to see Romano in this kind of role, and he acquits himself very well. He has a couple of moments where like this, his comedic timing is so on point to bring those like little moments of levity. His first meeting with De Niro that I know they show a little bit in the trailer, but they expand on in that scene. It's so good. And again, he's another character who has such a big presence, and then he just kind of goes away. He just kind of fades away like all these other side characters do. But I love him. And I got to say, I think he has grown as an actor so much that in a way that I didn't expect, but I'm just exhilarated by. So I want to talk about him any chance I get. And I'm also going to tell you, you should go see his show, Men of a Certain Age, that nobody watched but me. Because that's the start of like Ray Romano, like becoming this generation's Walter Matthau. And I'm here for it. And so go Ray Romano. Anyway, that's all I got. What do you, any other supporting characters you guys want to?
This movie's got, it's stacked with supporting characters. You got Harvey Keitel, Ray Romano, Bobby Cannavale, Jesse Plemons, Jack Huston. But there's another guy who shares an acting role with Robert De Niro. Both these guys have played Al Pacino. And I'm talking about Stephen Graham. He played Tony Pro, the yin to the yang of Jimmy Hoffa. And Tony Graham, I think, made a name for himself. We're going to see big things from him because he was brilliant in this movie. Very subtle, very nuanced. He was an asshole and he knew it, and it was great.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I had never, because I remember Stephen Graham, I didn't know him from very much else. You know, he was in Gangs in New York. I don't know how big of a, I don't remember off the top of my head how big of a role he's had, but you know, he's one of those character actors, and to be kind of that guy, to have to, you know, really, he's probably the fourth biggest part in the movie. And to go from these like titans of acting to this guy who maybe people aren't as familiar with, and for him to hold his own, especially in that scene we mentioned earlier with Pacino, you're right. I think it's great stuff.
Yep.
Stephen Graham was in Boardwalk Empire and played, as Al Capone. Mm-hmm. So
Robert De Niro played Al Capone, so.
Oh, that's funny. Felt like this felt very reminiscent of that, like Al Capone, like up and coming, like Tony Pro. They really played like he thought he was Al Capone.
Yeah.
He's playing gangster. Okay. So I know we're all incredibly high on this movie, but let's segue into what, if any, criticisms do you have of the film? Ryan, we'll start with you.
Yeah, you know, this movie is a masterpiece, and it was brilliantly done. Everything was great. The writing, the acting, everything, the direction, everything was put together great. And I don't know, my biggest thing is the cinematography. And I don't know if this was done on purpose, but the movie was very well lit. And I don't know if they did that on purpose just to tell a straight story. Because, you know, a lot of mob movies use shadow to show, like, the conflicting spirit or, you know, show the evil side of someone. But I think Scorsese just, he either didn't want to do that, or they just want to make the movie bright, because, you know, we all know, you know, in the real world, the lighting's not going to play to it like that. So he just told a straight story. I don't know if that's what the intent was, but I don't know.
If that played into the confliction of like Russell and Jimmy Hoffa. Do you know what I mean? Like, you didn't have like that whole thing. So it's like, you were kind of like, oh, is he his friend? Is he not?
The lighting is very straightforward. Like, it's just very, this is what the lighting is. You know, it doesn't really offer any contrasting with the shadows. So you don't really like, or on characters. It's just very straightforward.
Well, and I think that feels in line with what the movie is.
Right.
I think the movie's meant to be in its own way, the genre is straightforward, so that you really, what's front and center are these characters, you know. We've talked, I mean, in our conversation, I think everything we're talking about has more to do with the inner workings and thoughts of these people rather than, you know, the genre of movie that they're in. And I think I'd say that's all by design.
Yeah. And I can see it that way too, but you know, it's like, you know, do you want a little bit more? Because other Scorsese film, like Shutter Island, I mean, that the cinematography in that film is great.
So. Right. Well, and like Casino is gorgeous.
Yep.
Casino is such a beautiful movie to look at. Like if you had it on mute, it just, and this isn't that, but I don't think it's meant to be, it's like, I think it's beautiful in its like plainness.
And that's, I think that's what they were going for. So that's, you know, usually you want cinematography out of big movies like this, but the subtlety of it, you're like, okay, I can get behind this.
Well, and one thing we haven't even touched on is we haven't even talked about the de-aging technology that's used in this. Yeah. We're talking about the budget and the look of the film. I mean, we've made it that was like the big deal about, you know, you see these characters through decades. And I got to say, like, I thought I was stunned at how well that worked for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was fine. Like I had no problem with it. I mean, it's a very brief scene. I think the real standout here is the actually aging makeup they did on Pacino. Like, you know, Pacino, I love you, but you look like you were old and you look like crap. I mean, but that's all the effects of special makeup effect. So
yeah, there's a great discussion. If you're watching on Netflix and you still have an extra half hour after the 3.5 hours of the movie, there's a conversation.
Yes, that was great.
That was great to watch. So if you do want to see what they actually look like now, as opposed to, you know, how were they in the makeup and the CGI and all that sort of stuff, it was great. You know, there's nothing I think like groundbreaking or, you know, revealed in that, but it's also just fun to watch those four guys who clearly have a rapport together just kind of, you know, shoot the shit for a half an hour about this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Aaron, what did you have anything to say about the de-aging technology to work for you?
You know, for the most part, I didn't mind it, but we talked about this in the network that there were times and there were scenes where you could tell that the way that the actors were moving was not matching the age they were supposed to be in the scene. It could be a little bit distracting. Mm-hmm. And so I think the scene that really comes to mind is when he goes and when Robert De Niro beats up the grocer, you can tell like an almost 80-year-old man is kicking.
Yeah.
Sure. Even though he's supposed to be like in his 40s then, like it was like, I'm like, oh, this is hard. This is hard to...
A little hard to watch.
Yeah, I'm like, oh, okay.
A little hard to believe that an 80-year man's kicking the shit out of somebody.
Well, and so I guess, yeah, like, I mean, it's always so kind of funny, right, to like, for me to talk about criticisms, because it's like, I'm not making movies. You know, who am I to say? But I know that by watching that commentary, like Scorsese was saying, like in those scenes where he had younger characters, he wanted the aging because he's like, I wanted the mannerisms to be congruent. I wanted the body language to be congruent, not teaching someone else how to do all these mannerisms. And so I guess it was like, that one scene though was shot from a distance. It's like, couldn't you got a guy just for that one, you know, to make it a little more believable? But that was really it. Yeah. I thought the de-aging was pretty neat and well done.
That's the next evolution of this whole thing, is where you can then just put someone's face on another person's body.
Yeah.
You could just put like De Niro's face.
Rogue One style.
Exactly. That's like the next phase. So like the actor themselves can do like the whole thing in a chair, which I'm sure Bruce Willis will be thrilled about. Hey, I can sit here and just do it here. Okay. And you just put it on the guy. You're like, but no,
can I just say my lines?
Yeah, exactly. you do you, Bruce. But no, I think it is. Yeah, that is the one of the criticisms I do have. Yeah, the de-aging, I think in that scene, I think particularly was glaring. The other scene was where De Niro meets Pesci for the first time. And De Niro, I couldn't quite peg how old we were supposed to think De Niro was in that scene.
Yes.
But again, it's not it. I mean, it took me out for maybe a minute because I was thinking about that instead of thinking about the characters. But then as you moved on, everything else was fluid to the point where I what I loved about the fact that it's de-aging is, you didn't have to see somebody try to play a young De Niro. And because of that, I think you're always able to connect with the character more the more you spend with the actor. And I think the end moment lands much better because we feel like we've spent 3.5 hours with De Niro. Not 3.5 hours with Frank Sheeran necessarily.
Yep.
You know, so you know, it is that trade-off, and you know, it's similar to the when Captain Marvel de-aged Samuel Jackson, and yet you know when you watch him run, and it's like, oh, Sam, you know, the face is young, but the body is
weight.
You know? Your body's telling on you,
right? So I can understand that. The one criticism I would have of the film, and it's fairly minor, is I don't know if I ever bought that Frank was ever going to choose anybody but wasn't going to choose Russell in the end. I always thought, you know, and I don't know, and I think that's part of that is just because of the rapport. What we know of is De Niro and Pesci, and their chemistry is just so instantaneous and has such a history behind it that it's almost me projecting their relationship into this movie that I don't know if the conflict between, oh, should I honor my loyalty to Hoffa or honor my loyalty to Russell? I don't know if that landed with me as much as it was intended to. I'm not really sure, but I'm also not sure if it mattered, if it was supposed to matter ultimately that much to me.
Well, I could see that being a criticism of, again, kind of like a mob movie, right? Like, show me the mob movie where someone stands up to the mob and they walk away unscathed and sure, fine.
They don't.
You know what? Who stood up to the mob? Jimmy Hoffa. We know how that ended, kind of.
He's right? On an island.
But yeah, but right? Like, so I get that. So in that sense of people saying, oh, it's another mob movie, and to your point where you don't really know if he's ever going to walk away, like, I can see that.
But yeah, and I still fairly, pretty fairly minor. I know we've talked about this up top, but the length really didn't bother me. I would say, yeah, I think there was like the 2.5 hour mark or something like that, where I was like, okay, this drags a little bit at that moment. But other than that, I'm trying to rack my brains for criticisms of it, but yeah. That's really all I got. Is Aaron, did you anything else that you had?
No, I just like, I can understand if the way that you, if you like a faster paced movie, this is probably not going to be for you. Mm-hmm. If you don't want to spend 3 hours, just thinking about human relationships and those more like existential kind of questions, this might not be the movie that you're going to enjoy the most, or it's not going to be your top pick. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not that fast paced gangster movie. So, and if you like a fast paced gangster movie, this is not your movie.
Mm-hmm. Sure. No, yeah. I think that all hits on the head. And look, the elephant in the room here is obviously leading up to the release of The Irishman. Scorsese's name was all over the internet. It was all over Twitter. It was all over our Front Row feed regarding his comments about Marvel movies and what he believes is cinema and isn't cinema. I'm not necessarily here to litigate that. In terms of his opinion about Marvel. I think what we can say about it is, obviously Scorsese, and he has said that he got to make the exact movie he wanted to make. Netflix just gave him carte blanche. This is what he finds to be, what he goes to the movies for. Like what you said, Aaron, this movie's complex. It requires, I think, and again, this is not to sound pretentious. I love a great escapist movie as much as anybody. I love all the Marvel movies. I love a good, dumb comedy, you know, as you pointed out, and some people, it's like, if you just want to forget about your problems and you just want to be whisked away and not, you know, be challenged in with, you know, I don't even like to say that, because that sounds pretentious.
If you these type of emotions are not the type of emotions you're feeling called or equipped to sit in,
right,
then it's not the type of cinema that's maybe for you.
Sure. And I think that word emotion is great, because to me, when you look at, what do you go for to a movie? Are you looking to just be emotionally impacted by something and get like that kind of cathartic ride, similar to what you get at a theme park?
Yeah.
Or are you looking for something that's maybe going to kind of get you, you know, thinking, and maybe you walk out and you don't have all the answers when you're done watching it. And a movie doesn't like put its heart on its sleeve and say, this is who you should like, this is who you should dislike, this is clearly what I was trying to say in this. Those are just different things. And I think there's plenty of room for both of those.
Yeah.
I think what Scorsese says about these kinds of movies maybe not being able to be done in theaters as much is a conversation for a different day. And I think it's warranted, but I don't know. I think, like what you like and don't, you know, don't be mad, you know, don't let anybody, you know, some, another podcast says, don't let anybody else yuck your yum. But as far as what I think, what I loved about this movie is that I thought way more about this movie, after the fact than I did probably almost any other movie this year. And so for that, that's one of the things I love about it.
Yep.
Phil, oh my gosh. I don't know why I said Phil, but Lou, I think you said it best when you said you almost knew 100% that you were going to like or love the movie, but what you weren't expecting from it was to be moved by it.
Mm-hmm.
And I really think that sums up The Irishman. You know, for Stacey's vision of what he wanted for this film to elicit in people.
I don't, you know, I like watching movies and I sit and I think about it, but this is a movie that I actually stopped immediately after and I thought about, because that final scene was so powerful, mm-hmm. you know, the isolationism that he experienced because of his life choices ultimately and his isolation of his family. I mean, the movie is profound on so many levels and it sticks with you. It really does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, it's such a thorny topic because it's hard to talk about. I've always felt like art does two things. Can do intellectually resonant with you. And to me, the true work of art is something that balances those two. And I don't think that because one does one thing and the other does another, there's more value in one or the other.
Right.
I say this as someone who cried, you know, every time I see Endgame. Okay.
Yeah.
I was emotionally impacted by that movie. I think that movie, where's the emotions come to you, they bring the emotions to you. They mm-hmm. put it there for you. It's more accessible for an audience member who wants a story to kind of envelop them. Mm-hmm. The Irishman, as opposed to that, is a movie where I think when we talked about this with the length, you have to be willing to invest your time to this. It's not a movie you can watch while you're doing the laundry. It's not a movie you can watch. If you try to do that, then the ending will mean nothing to you.
You have to give yourself to the movie.
Correct. You've got to kind of meet it halfway. Yep. And there are some movies you have to go all the way. And those aren't, you know, that are solely intellectually. I think this movie's very emotional in a lot of ways, but there's a little bit of heavy lifting on the audience's part too, that I think escapist entertainment doesn't necessarily do, even though there's beautiful entertainment out there. So I don't know. That's just me. That's me like trying to cover my ass to make sure people think I'm not like, I'm not trying to be all pretentious about this and be like, well, this is this and this is that. And, you know, but
we're in an age, and I'm just going to say it. Like, we're also in a precarious state right now where like it's become unsafe for anyone to have opinions. Just like Martin Scorsese had an opinion of how he felt about those films. And it was merely that, an opinion. It didn't mean that it should destroy or crumble what everyone else feels about Marvel movies or superhero films. And just like your opinion about what you think about Martin Scorsese's opinion shouldn't offend people. It's just, we all get to feel the way we feel and move on from it and hopefully listen and say either, yeah, I agree, or hey, I didn't think about it that way, or this is a good point, or it's not really the way that I see things, and continue watching and doing and things that we love.
You know, and going off that is, you know, Scorsese grew up among giants, Coppola, you know, Spielberg. And in his age, it was the golden age of cinema. And some of the films that came out of that era are some of the best in our time. But who's to say that, you know, what we have going on and what's being put out right now isn't the golden age of cinema. Time will tell. So people are so quick to ram down a throat. But I mean, we look back at it now. I'm not blasting the Marvel movies. They're great movies. But, you know, it's all a matter of time, you know. Scorsese is neither right or wrong. He's just telling, like you said, Aaron, it's his opinion. And he's just being very straightforward with it. And I think we have to take it like that.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And I think, and we've said this in the past, that I don't think Scorsese is 100% right in what he says of Marvel's movies, because I think there's some Marvel movies that do challenge me and make me think about things. It's one of the reasons Black Panther is my number one, because every time I watch that movie, I'm kind of challenged with some of the social ideas that that movie presents. Dark Knight does the same thing. And I don't know if he's seen those particular movies to say that. I mean, maybe he only watched the first, you know, couple Marvel movies and tapped out. And those first couple movies don't really do that because they're setting things up for later. That's a, you know, that's a whole digression just to say, I think because we get so emotionally attached to certain things, when somebody says something that criticizes it, we're wanting to like, you know, really push back, especially in this day and age where, you know, things are everybody's hearts on their sleeves in 2019, it feels like. And, you know, I think we can debate and we can have a dialogue about these kinds of things, all of it to say, like what you like, love what you love, be willing to hear criticism, be willing to talk about criticism, and don't necessarily think that just because somebody is critical of something you like, it means they don't like you, or it's some sort, you know,
or that what you like is less than it actually, or its value is less.
Correct. Yeah. Or that you're dumb for liking certain things, or that you're, you know, all of that sort of stuff. And so I think that's just, you know, it's Christmas time. Let's all just, you know, let's just let the spirit of the holidays envelop all of us. We'll just all, you know, let's all hug it out.
There you go.
I was thinking about that mentality they had, if they had that mentality back then.
Exactly. You know,
I still don't think what Martin Scorsese said was as offensive as Francis Ford Coppola said about
them. Oh, he went off the deep end.
Right. Yeah. 100%. And look, that I'm sure we will probably revisit this conversation when we do our Oscar spotlight on The Irishman, because I do think this movie's heavily in the conversation for awards season. Yeah. So
it's going to get so many nods.
Yeah, it is. It's good. And it deserves every single one of them. It could win Best Picture, and at this moment, I'm not mad at that. It's certainly no Green Book. It's so sorry. You know, again, if you like Green Book, that's fine. That's you. You do you. But I got some thoughts. But anyway, So we'll I'm sure this will be a conversation. All of that is to say, as long as it's a conversation, as long as it's a dialogue that we can have with each other and know that, you know, if this isn't your, this kind of movie isn't your thing, even, I don't know if it's not, why you'd still be into, you know, minute 90 of this podcast. But if it is, you know, if it's not, that's cool. If it is, great. And let's, as long as we can talk about it. But okay, final thoughts on The Irishman before we wrap up. Is there anything you want to do, say, to put a bow on this? Aaron, we'll start with you.
I think I've said all I need to say about The Irishman before I do cry for a third time.
Okay. All right, Ryan, how about you?
I'm a big awards guy. The Front Row knows this. I was all hyped for the Golden Globe nominations. This movie is going to go far, and as it should, because it is Scorsese's masterpiece, and I think he's going to get recognized for that.
Yep. I agree with you. There's nothing more I can say. I love the fact that it still makes me think. I watched this movie. Yep. It's been almost 2 weeks since I've seen it, and I'm still thinking and have new thoughts about it. And I'm excited to watch it again. And I think that's, again, the sign of what I think, in my opinion, one of the things that makes something really work as a piece of art is that you can keep going back to it and have new questions and new thoughts and see things you didn't see. And I think you guys have brought up some great stuff that I didn't think about. And I think that's one of the hallmarks of why I think this movie is in the conversation for Best Picture. And I think it deserves to be in the conversation for one of Scorsese's best films of all time. So, all right, that's going to do it for our discussion of The Irishman. Hope you like the new format of Full Disclosure. I think we're going to try to adopt this moving forward with some non-spoiler talk followed by a bit of a deeper dive. But we have got so much stuff coming up. We are closing out the year fast and furious. We've got a lot of stuff. As you're hearing this, I know we've got a couple of major new releases that we're going to be doing some full disclosures on. Obviously, Star Wars Rise of Skywalker is coming out. I know we're going to be doing a full disclosure. I don't know if that's going to include any of us. Who knows? But of course, the other big movie that's coming out, smile on my face is already growing. Cats is coming out. how in 2019 I'm more excited for a Cats movie than a Star Wars movie. I don't know how we got here, folks, but here we are.
I need an adult.
So I'm right here. I'm ready for Cats. So you're going to get a guilty pleasure / full disclosure on Cats. You definitely get a full disclosure on Rise of Skywalker. As far as my podcast guilty pleasures comes, we haven't forgotten about Christmas. Don't worry. We've got a new full disclosure coming out sometime this week, I think, or just in time for Christmas, where we're going to be discussing another Netflix movie, The Night Before Christmas, KNIGHT Before Christmas.
Oh, God.
Starring Vanessa Hudgens and a time traveling knight.
Yes.
At Kate Christmas. Leopold?
What more do you need? So I'm excited about all that sort of stuff. And obviously, as award season is ramping up, we're going to start doing some profiles of all the major nominees. We're going to have coverage of all of that sort of stuff. Everything that we can throw at you. So stay dialed into that. Ryan, do you got anything coming up with flashbacks?
Yes, I miss November, but we're going to make up for it. We're going to honor the 30th anniversary of When Harry Met Sally, a great romantic comedy. And then we are also going to do a Christmas one, also celebrating another 30th anniversary. And of course, that comes from Christmas Vacation and all its glory. So.
Excellent. Well, and if you are wanting all things 1989, you can also go back and hear my most recent Guilty Pleasure on my independent feed, Guilty Pleasures, where we talked about a similar iconic duo to Harry and Sally. We talked Tango and Cash. So a movie, 1989 was a great year. I love that year. So we had a lot of fun. So make sure you dial in on that. And the way you can do that is by making sure that you follow us on Twitter at Front Row Reviews with a Z. You can subscribe to our feed wherever you get your podcasts, iTunes, Spotify. You can find us at frnpod.com. You can also find us through nprillinois.org on the Community Voices page and our Facebook page, the Front Row Network. And that will give you links to all of our shows whenever they drop so that you are in tune for that. Our live shows are out there. Our best movie of the decade was already out. So you can go back and find that where we duked it out. I'm going to have an article coming out on frnpod.com about the top 10 guilty pleasures of the decade. I'm excited to reveal that list. So all sorts of stuff, and you can find me on Twitter at the fake Lou Hare. Let me know what you thought of The Irishman and what you're excited for in the holiday season and in the awards season. Aaron, how about you? You got any social media you want to plug?
I've been kind of quiet. I'm revamping my social media, so maybe next time. Maybe for that cats full disclosure, and I'm going to try to join you.
Yes.
Taylor Swift, Oscar bait.
My husband, I keep being like, well, hold on, I got to look at the times. He's like, let's figure out Skywalker. I'm like, I got to look at the times for Cats. He's like, no one is talking about Cats. I'm like,
you guys are ridiculous.
Me and Lou are talking about Cats.
There's about two of us. I have a double feature on Friday. It is Cats in the morning. It's Star Wars in the afternoon. Merry Christmas to me.
I fully support this.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you, Aaron. You get me.
Yes.
All right. Ryan, how about you? Do you got anything else you want to plug?
No, just looking forward to that. Flashbacks. That's it.
All right. Well, thank you both so much for coming on. Thank you for listening. Hope you check out The Irishman and you check out everything else that we're doing for the month of December and into the year 2020. We've got you covered on anything movies. You can find it. And hopefully you enjoy your holiday season. You enjoy the new year. But until next time, for the Front Row Network, I'm Lou Hare.
I'm Ryan Lutens.
I'm Aaron McCabe.
And as always, we'll see you in the front row.